The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I wrote this book called Never Give In, 2495. Once I've signed it, you can't return it. It'd be worth about $10. But I will be signing them later this evening. I want to introduce my co-author, Frank Statera, who... Stand up, Frank. Stand up. I'm a little concerned that he got more applause than I did. But that's a part of the risk of this line. I wrote this book because I wanted to tell other people what happened to me, and I think it will be useful to people who have cancer. And it is a scourge in our society, and it's a tough illness to fight, and I fought it, and at least so far I got my fingers crossed successfully. And the start of the battle, as I write in this book, is to acknowledge what you have, what is. Don't feel sorry for yourself. No use asking the question, why me? What did I do to deserve this? And approach it with a positive mental attitude. First thing I did was to consult with my family about how to handle it in a political context. The medical context comes first, and the political context is not far behind. And once I knew I had it, the family sat down, and I turned to Pennsylvania's most astute political mind, our older son, Jana. And he operates on the principle, as I do, of tell it all and tell it now and tell it fast. And we got the diagnosis on the afternoon, and 5 o'clock on what they call a hastily called news conference, I faced the news reporters. And I did it with a genuine positive attitude. I said I beat 2 brain tumors, double bypass surgery, and a lot of political opponents, and I'm going to beat this too. And that's how I felt about it. Had a great doctor, Dr. John Glick, a leading national oncologist, and he said you have a 70% chance to live 5 years. Well, as far as I was concerned, the 70% didn't apply to me. And the 5 years didn't either, as far as I was concerned. And then I started chemotherapy. And chemotherapy is a very tough regimen. They put a lot of tough stuff into your system. You have an illness, and the chemicals fight it out. It's the war of the worlds inside your body. And it's very, very debilitating. And I made up my mind that I was going to drag myself out of bed every morning and go to the squash court. I couldn't play 5 or 6 games, but I played 2 or 3. And I would drag myself to the Senate, and fortunately, I had a lot of distraction. I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We had a lot of really tough work to do, including the confirmation hearings of Roberts and Alito. And the Judiciary Committee attracts the senators who have the most extreme views on both sides of the political spectrum. The most liberal senators, Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden and Pat Leahy and Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin and Russell Feingold, and on the Republican side, Orrin Hatch and Chuck Grassley and Jeff Sessions and Tom Coburn and John Cornyn, and it was a real battle. And the tougher the day was, the better I liked it, because I didn't have any time to think about myself. And it was great, great therapy. So the second lesson after accepting what is to stay on the job and continue to work. And it's not easy. I'd look in the mirror every day. At first, I looked in the mirror to shave. And after a while, I didn't have to shave because I lost all my hair. But I still looked in the mirror. And we were legislating on identity theft at that time. A lot of people were having their credit cards and Social Security stolen. And I'd look at myself in the mirror, and I thought to myself, I'm a victim of identity theft. Who is this person? I tried to keep a light vein to the extent that I could, tried to laugh a little. Laughing beats crying. And when I grew bald and pale and thin, I sometimes wondered if I was going to make it. I didn't ponder long on death, but the thought flashed across my mind a little. And I thought of a movie I saw when I was a youngster, Lionel Barrymore. It was called Death Takes a Holiday. And in this movie, the angel of death comes, and the angel of death is after a little boy. And the little boy wins, so death takes a holiday. So I figured that every day is a bonus day. Today's a bonus day. Today I might not have had. And people respond to you in a very, very different way. I went to a 76ers game. Shannon has very expensive seats. Couldn't begin to afford Shannon's seats on the 76ers game. You know how much it costs to sit on the front row, the 76ers? Well, I don't know either. I didn't buy the ticket. But anyhow, Ed Rendell sits on the front row, too. And Rendell walked by me, and I said, "How you doing, Ed?" And he looked at me as if he didn't know me. And you know why he looked at me as if he didn't know me? Because he didn't know me. I had changed that much. That wasn't really very gallant of Rendell. You know, I gave him his first job out of law school. He was a law student at Villanova, and I interviewed him. And I thought he was a very promising young lawyer. Now he's governor, still making a lot of promises. That's a laugh line. Should produce a bigger laugh than that. You guys will never get into the Jon Stewart show, let me tell you this. I was on the Jon Stewart show last week. Anybody have the misfortune to see the Jon Stewart show? How can you watch the Jon Stewart show? Joan and I were in the green room looking at the first two segments. I was on segment three. And I was just amazed. I decided when I went out there, if I got a chance, I was going to say, you must select and screen this audience very carefully to find this many people who will laugh at anything. I didn't get a chance to say it all. I got a chance to say was, this crowd will laugh at anything. And you know what happened? They laughed. And then I said, see, they'll laugh at anything. I was in the White House with the president on July 21st. And we took a picture . I think the merchandising is not very good. They should have sold you a copy before you came in. Because if they had, you could see the picture that I'm about to show you, which you can't see at this distance, so you have to buy a copy. But it's a picture of me at the very end of my chemotherapy, the last installment was the next day, And I'm standing here, and the president's shaking my hand. And I'm bald as a billiard ball, thin and pale and gaunt. This is a photo. I'll take it. And the president's shaking my hand sort of like this. The body language is unmistakable. And in the book, I speculate about what President Bush is thinking. One thing I surmise is he's thinking, I got to shake his hand. He's the chairman. And I think he may be thinking, I don't think he's going to make it. Or he may be thinking, they say it isn't contagious, but who in the hell knows? It's sort of a natural reaction to shake hands with somebody that you think may not make it. There are some good pictures here. There's Hugo Chavez. And you may wonder why I was shaking hands with Hugo Chavez. Well, you have to buy the book if you want to find out. The experiences I've had with the medical profession have been schlecht. Anybody know what schlecht means? You know what schlecht means. You know what schlecht means. Rotten, lousy, that's right. On two occasions, I've been diagnosed with fatal illnesses. In 1979, I had some pain in my left arm, and a doctor gave me a fancy electroencephalogram. And he looked at it, and he said, you've got amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. That's ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. So I went to the library and looked it up and said, you wouldn't live very long. And a few weeks later, when no symptoms developed, the doctor, one of the city's most prominent neurologists, said, I was wrong. The electroencephalogram reading was consistent with having a mild case of polio as a child. Now, if you want to find out what I said to that doctor, it's on page 232. June 11th, 1993, I remember the date for a reason you'll soon understand, I had an MRI. I'd had a collar which was tight and light pains running down the side of my head. And I wanted an MRI. And the doctor said, you don't need one. I said, well, it's non-invasive, and I want one. So I had the MRI, and the chief neurosurgeon at Bethesda Naval Hospital read the MRI, and he showed me a spot on the film, and he said, do you see this? He said, that's a malignant brain tumor. You have 3 to 6 weeks to live. This is a true story. You don't get many out of Washington. This is a true story. So in sort of a rambling chain of consciousness, I said, oh, Joan's on her way down. We're going to go to a resort. This is our anniversary on Monday, the 14th. Joan insisted on being married on Flag Day. She wanted to be able to remember her anniversary. So the doctor looked at me, and I told him I was going to go away for the weekend to celebrate our anniversary. And he said, go and have a good time. I thought to myself, this guy must be crazy. I said, give me the films. I'm going to Philadelphia. And, you know, the ride is about an hour and a half. It was the longest train ride of my life. And it was operated on the following Monday. And I later found out that you can't tell if a tumor is malignant or benign until you take it out and freeze it, and slice it down, and look at it under a microscope. That's the only way you can make a determination that it is malignant. On that day, coincidentally, Governor Casey had double bypass at UPMC in Pittsburgh. And the next day on the Daily News, they had a picture of Governor Casey on one side looking to his left and a picture of me on the other side looking to the right. So we sort of looking toward each other, and a big headline, anguish. And the rumor was, the report was, they took the next day off in Harrisburg. Not to sympathize, but to calculate who would take his place, and who would take the guy who took his place, and who would take my place. And who. They would work up the ladder. And Ed Rendell was quoted in the newspaper as saying that he received a large number of calls when it was publicized that I had a Hodgkin's, and people wanted my job. And Rendell thought that that was pretty ghoulish, and it was, and said that I would outlive them all. Now, on this one occasion, Rendell may be right. I hope so, and I plan so. In the book, I tell about our efforts to increase funding for the National Institutes of Health. Foxchase needs a lot more money on cancer research, right, Doug? So does HUP, and so does Jefferson, and so do all the research facilities across the country. And I felt that way from the start. First committee I chose was appropriations. The first subcommittee was health. That was when I was first elected in 1980. And I've taken the lead along with Senator Tom Harkin on a bipartisan basis. Tom's a Democrat from Iowa, to increase federal funding from 12 to almost $30 billion. And for a time when we were increasing the funding, $3.5 billion, it was very, very helpful. A lot of new grants. But the discretionary budget has dried up. I'm hopeful of becoming chairman of the Appropriations Committee one day. I don't mind being interrupted from applause. That's okay. Would have thought more people would have applauded that. Only Thad Cochran from Mississippi is ahead of me on the Republican side, and he's term limited. And with a re-election in 2010 and parties change power, I'll be the chairman. And what I'd like to do, hadn't been done in the 28 years I've been there, is to have a reevaluation of priorities, top to bottom. We have a federal budget of $3.1 trillion. It's a staggering sum of money. Nobody can calculate it. And to have a federal budget for NIH of $30 billion, less than 1%, scandalous. Not to have federal funding for embryonic stem cell research is scandalous. And I was asked earlier this evening what's my biggest frustration, and it's that we haven't had adequate funding. Because if we had prosecuted the war on cancer that President Nixon declared in 1970, Judge Becker would still be alive today, died too soon from prostate cancer. Paula Klein, the wife of Shana's law partner, Tom Klein, wouldn't have died of breast cancer. Beautiful young woman, young children at the age of 55. And my chief of staff, a young woman named Carrie Lackman, 48, wouldn't have died of breast cancer, and I wouldn't have gotten Hodgkin's. The story about Joan's friend from high school is a good concluding story to encapsulate why I wrote the book. Joan has a friend named Harriet Lesser. She married a fellow named Marvin Park, and they live in California. And Marvin developed lymphoma. And he got very despondent and very depressed and wouldn't get out of bed. He wouldn't even pay attention to his favorite, his dog, whom he loved to walk. And Harriet talked to Joan and told her what was going on, and Joan took an advanced copy of my book a couple months ago and sent it to the Parks. And Marvin read the book. And Harriet reported to Joan. Marvin said, if Arlen Specter can do it, so can I. And he said, get me my clothes. I'm getting out of bed. He got out of bed and got dressed and walked the dog. It was the first time he'd been out of bed in weeks. And he was the same guy physiologically when he was morosely lying in bed and that he was when he got the book, and he was able to walk. And I think if more people see that guys who look at you funny, even if it's the president or even if it's the governor, don't recognize you, that it makes it a little easier. And you can do a lot more than you think you can do if you make up your mind. And this book tells a story, and there are a lot of comments on what we had to go through with some of the tough stuff politically and governmentally. I had a very high compliment. My daughter-in-law, Tracy, told me this evening that she'd finished the book, and it's a good read. So can't say any more than that. The next editions, there are going to be some corrections, however. My 10-year-old granddaughter, Lily, was 7. And when she found out that I had cancer, she said to me, as only a 7-year-old can, my granddaughters call me Arlen. I like the youth bit, so I have them call me Arlen. And she said to me, Arlen, I love you. I mean, I really love you. It isn't that I like you. I really love you, and I'm going to be a nurse. That's what 7-year-old Lily said. So I showed her how to read a book. First thing you do is turn to the index. Find out what pages you're on. This book is so short, you won't have to do that. And anyhow, you're not mentioned, by and large. So Lily read the part about being a nurse, and she said, Arlen, I've changed my mind. I'm not going to be a nurse. I'm going to be a writer and an actress. And I said, okay, Lily, I'll change it for the second edition. But there won't be a second edition unless you all buy copies. Okay, they want me to take questions. Let me see how many questions there are so I know how long my answers can be. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Going, going, going. 9, 10, 11. Gone. You're in charge. Find them.
Oh, thank you. Senator Spector, as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Able Danger hearings, how do you feel about the outcome of those hearings with the reality that several prominent members of the Able Danger Project were not allowed to testify because of, just certain procedures?
You say people weren't allowed to testify? Yeah. Whom do you mean? To testify in the confirmation hearings on Able Danger? Well, that wasn't with respect to the confirmation hearings on the Supreme Court nominees. We could not get them to testify because the Department of Defense wouldn't let them testify. Yeah. Well, Able Danger had some items which were potentially embarrassing to the Department of Defense, and we pushed ahead as far as we could, and they refused to allow them to testify on grounds of national security. And we, like the song from Oklahoma, we went about as far as we could go. We got pretty far and exposed a lot of it, but couldn't pursue it beyond that. Well, the question is about retribution. We looked into that and did our very best to protect him. It's a rough game down there when you have somebody who is willing to come and expose the truth. And very hard to give them adequate protection because the federal government, there are lots of subtle ways of having retribution. But that subject is not covered in my book, not the only one. Number two on the way to 11.
Oh, number two. All right. I've been in Bucks County since 1982. You've been my senator for 30 years. I started this morning out in Long Island, came down to visit with you. My sister is 68, and she's been teaching school to children in New York City school system until she had a grand mal seizure in May of last year. It turns out there is a beast out there called a glioblastoma multiforme, or short term for GBM. It is half of the fatalities within brain cancer, and within 1 year after diagnosis, 99% of the people who get this diagnosis is gone. And so,
what is it again? Which is the cause?
Glioblastoma multiforme, and it doubles every 7 days, and it just eats the brain alive. And it's half of the tumor. It's half of the fatalities within brain cancer.
And you're saying that there is some causative factor in that neighborhood.
Obviously she lived in Long Island, which is Cancer Alley kind of thing. But the point that happens then is the family, and I'm a very highly skilled technologist, goes to work as to how to save my sister. And the first thing you do, it turns out that Amazon.com, for example, has an index where it lists all the best-selling brain cancer books. And so you suck those up. And then you go looking for the best team that can be the place. And you go looking for the best institution that has that team. And you look for the best machinery that will attack this thing and kill this thing because you have a tick-tock clock. And you call up the National Institute of Health and you say, who is the best team? Who, you know, if I was a golfer, I would know that, you know, he is the best of the best of the best of the best. It is so difficult when you have somebody who's very, very dear to you that has this one-year prognosis to find who is going to be your team in this country and how we can rank those people saying, you know, this, if it's your sister or your loved one, and so she's now on the second clinical trial because the conventional ones have already left her.
Did NIH help you find somebody?
No, they were very helpful. They understood that I had a kind of like a thermonuclear war at hand. They understood when once I say glioblastoma multiforme, they know that you're in very, very serious trouble, you know. And so they were very, very sensitive to this. But because of the way the organization works, they're not able to tell you in good form who is the best of the best, you know. We have wonderful insurance and such. But it's hard to find the humans and the institutes and the machinery to go attack this thing and kill it. And so that's what I
Has she found an adequate doctor?
The reason we're out there on Long Island is because this thing just eats your life and your brain up, and she's starting to lose cognition and slipping, sliding, and it is just a monster. So I just tell you that, you know, if you look at brain cancer from the what kills the most, as opposed to what's interesting. And we have 100 clinical trials out there, and now you have to pick and choose which one. She's on Avastin right now, which, by the way, costs $80,000 a month. To $80,000 a month for this chemotherapy. And, boy, and then, you know, if the tumor shrinks, we keep it. If the tumor doesn't shrink, we try something new. And that's the world of this brain cancer thing. And in a year, they're gone. They're just gone.
Well, I don't know quite how to respond. I know there are some great doctors around at Fox Chase and Hup, and I also have a sense that if we had invested more in NIH research since 1970, there would have been a chance to find the answer. Number three on the way to 11.
Thank you. I praise your fight and your stamina and your wonderful sense of humor in your adventure. I too am a cancer patient, but I am on Medicare, and I am finding that healthy skepticism help a healthy skeptic is not a welcome event in that situation. Let me see. Let me see if I can just find my little thing here for a question.
Take your time.
Why doesn't Medicare include adequate coverage for survivorship and maintenance? Because surveillance is lifelong, as you well know. You have to keep going back to your doctors and make sure that things don't come back or report themselves again. And you need to be looked at in an awesome manner.
Let me take a look at your specific situation. I can't answer the question in the abstract. But Mike Oscar is here, executive director of my Philadelphia office, and I'd be glad to take a look at your situation and see what Medicare is doing for you. Number four on the way to 11.
Yes, it's great to be here with you, sir. I'm 24 years old, and I followed your career since I was probably about this tall, and this is the first time I've had the pleasure of seeing you speak live. And it's kind of a generic, broad question that I want to ask you. I know you've been in the U.S. Senate for 28 years and had various other political positions before that time, and I'd like to know what accomplishment in your career you're most proud of.
What accomplishment in my career I'm most proud of? I'm frequently asked what will my legacy be, and my standard answer to that is it's too early in my career to pick one. But it would be the NIH funding. I've authored some important legislation, the Armed Career Criminal Bill and Terrorist Prosecution Act and Inspector General for the CIA and some of the work on the veterans' medical problems, NIH funding, I think, would be the most significant. Number five on the way to 11.
Senator Spector,
yes,
thank you for coming. I think one of the greatest things that you did was in your youth. You came to Philadelphia, got an education, left and went to Yale, the Air Force, and came back to Philadelphia. And you met one of the finest men in this country, Ed Becker. And I think that combination of that friendship gave you an inner strength that very few men ever achieve outside of their home. My question is, as a member of the subcommittee on health, have you ever thought about adding prevention through nutrition being taught in the public schools starting in the first grade, which helps any individual who has the experience of discovering that they have a malignancy?
Well, the answer is yes. We have very substantial funding that comes out of the subcommittee on education, and prevention is very important. Senator Harkin has taken the lead on that, and he calls it wellness. He doesn't call it medical care. He calls it a wellness approach. And I've seen the advantages of diet. Joan is an expert, and our younger son, Steve, who's an MD, is also a PhD in nutrition. And his career goal is helping people with obesity. Number six on the way to 11.
Senator Spector, thank you for your presentation. I look forward to reading your book. Assuming that everybody in here buys one and you sell a lot of copies, what will you do with the money?
Frank and I plan to give some of it to the Cancer Society. And frankly, I don't anticipate a whole lot of money. I never count chickens, and I didn't write this book to make money. But Joan will figure out something. Number seven on the way to 11.
Hi, Senator Spector. I'd like to congratulate you on your successful fight against cancer. I also had Hodgkin's last year. And I had great insurance.
How are you feeling?
Feeling good.
Did you have chemotherapy?
Yeah.
Where'd you get that great head of hair?
It all grew back.
Good.
So, I guess what I wanted to ask you is I had great health insurance, but I was sort of struck when I would look at the bills at how much it would cost me if I didn't. And I'm wondering what your position is or what you feel government's role should be in helping people who, you know, aren't lucky enough. I was lucky I had health insurance, and this is potentially something I have to deal with, you know, for the rest of my life, you know, monitoring and stuff like that. But what do you see as the government's role in that, in making sure that not just that we have the best health care out there, best technology, but also making sure that people can afford it?
What is the government's role on health care? We are working to try to get the 40 million plus Americans who do not have coverage health insurance. We have a number of ideas on incremental coverage, which candidly haven't worked out too well. Trying to get an antitrust exemption for small business. General Motors gets a much lower rate than a 15-person firm. There's a very intriguing bill which is now pending, sponsored by Senator Wyden of Oregon and Senator Bennett of Utah, which would mandate health insurance. It's a federal approach like they had in Massachusetts with Governor Romney. Like automobile insurance, you have to have it. And I'm taking a close look at it. The considerations are that in our free society, you don't like to mandate, tell people what they have to do. You tell people they have to have auto insurance because they might hurt somebody, and that person ought to be covered if a driver is at fault. And it may be that we'll have to go to mandating it. There have to be very substantial subsidies for the poor, which I think government can handle. We're doing that now with Medicaid. We're doing that now with SCHIP. But I don't like the single payer. I don't like President Clinton's plan, which puts a gigantic bureaucracy between the doctor and the patient. But it may be this mandatory line is what ought to be done. What are we up to, 8 or 9? Go ahead. You're the man in charge. Is this number 8 or 9? Good. 9 on the way to 11.
How you doing, Senator? I just wanted to commend you on your battle with cancer, and I hope you have many good healthy years ahead of you. I have a twofold question for you. Dating back to 2001 and specifically the anthrax attacks, it's now well known that the strain of anthrax that was used was the Ames strain, which can be taken back to Fort Detrick, Maryland, part of the bioweapons defense program. Now, with that being said, how can we as the American people look at that now known knowledge and say to ourselves that Al-Qaeda or terrorists infiltrated the highest levels of our government to be able to get that strain out and cause the mayhem that it did? And my second part of that question is, did the anthrax attacks have anything to do with the vote that you had on the Patriot Act just a couple months after?
Well, the answers to your questions are I don't know is to number one, and no is to number two. Who has the next question? Just kidding, just kidding. I don't think there's any connection between the anthrax attack and Al-Qaeda. Those anthrax attacks were investigated very, very extensively. Senator Leahy was the subject of one and had bodyguards for a long time. Senator Daschle was another target, and they've never been able to really find the culprits on those attacks. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I think the matter is still an open matter and under investigation. And I do not think it had anything to do with the Patriot Act. We passed the Patriot Act in 2006. We had it on the floor in December of 2005 when the New York Times broke the story on the terrorist surveillance program, but I don't think it had anything to do with the Patriot Act. Number 10 on the way to 11.
Thank you, Senator Spector. I was wondering if you received any political ill will from your fellow Republicans for breaking ranks on the stem cell issue. And if so, what has been the fallout?
Breaking ranks on what? There are so many, I have to have a specification.
Stem cell issue.
I don't think so. The question is, if I had reprisals from the Republican Party for breaking ranks on the stem cells, the Republican Party is pretty used to my speaking my mind, and we were able to persuade a lot of Republicans to join me on voting for embryonic stem cell research for federal funding. We had 66 senators vote that way. We're one short of enough to override a veto. And a lot of the senators who voted that way are senators who identify themselves as pro-life senators. You have 400,000 of these embryos, which are going to be lost if they're not used. I took the lead in putting up $2 million for embryo adoption. People would take these embryos and turn them into life. I wouldn't want to use them for medical research, but they're going to be used or thrown away. But I've withstood that. Had quite a few conversations with the president about it. This was a hot topic when he comes to Pennsylvania. He customarily invites members of Congress, and he likes to talk. See a lot of him in the plane or in cars. Up close, he's very much engaged. Senator Santorum and President Bush and I took one car ride and talked at some length about embryonic stem cell research. Won't surprise you to know the vote was 2-1. And it won't surprise you to know that the president didn't need anybody with him. Under Lincoln's cabinet, you know that story. Went around the cabinet room and there were six ayes, and he said the nays had it. But he still talked to me after I disagreed with him. In fact, he even shook my hand. It's in the book. Last question. Who's got the last question? I see two hands up. Are you telling me I can't count? Okay, this is 11 and that's 11A. I'll take both questions. No, you're 11. He's 11A. Oh,
okay. Senator, thank you for being here. And again, as everybody, we all agree, congratulations. We're very glad to see you alive and well and hope it continues for a good long time.
Thank you.
Thank you also for your work in fighting for stem cell research and fighting for more funding for for the NIH. Really, it's something.
Thank you.
And I'm a Democrat, so, you know. And I'm a Democrat, so, you know.
I suspected that.
You probably.
I'll bet there are other Democrats here.
I think a few of us are here.
I want you, since you brought up politics, I want you to become a Republican for a day. One day. It's not asking you to change your religion. But in 2010, my last election was 1%, 50.6 to 49.4. And my opponent is now president of the Club for Growth. They got a lot of 527s. Rendell took a lot of Republicans and changed them to Democrats. And a lot of Republicans are now changing for the Democratic primary. There may not be any centrist Republicans to vote for me if you don't change.
Go ahead. I'll look into that. I'll give you another word also.
Can I mark you down as a definite maybe?
And another. It's a maybe, and that's final. I'll give you another word, by the way, for schlecht, which goes right with it, which is chaloshes, which you probably know the good old word chaloshes for schlecht. Those doctors that you were telling us about were truly chaloshes. I have a little more
Talk
difficult...
Talk to my wife. Go ahead.
A more difficult question, though. I'm sorry to bring this up, but the war has cost a fortune. And I'm wondering where you stand in trying to get some of the money, instead of sending it to more war, to be used for more health?
Well, that's what I told you on reassessing the priorities, not automatically $500 billion for defense, $50 billion for homeland security, etc. You got one more question of the man all the way in the back. Listen, had we known Saddam did not have weapons of mass destruction, we wouldn't have gone into Iraq. Once there, we don't want to leave it destabilized. But the patience is growing very thin. And there's been a lot of adverse comment when the reports came out a few days ago that they're changing the, that General Petraeus wants to change the plans which were announced to have withdrawals on five brigades. I'm glad to see that they're sticking with 12-month deployments and not 15. But we're going to be looking at what General Petraeus has to say very closely. He'll be back in Washington and he'll be testifying. And there's no doubt that we need an exit strategy. Very last question, 11A.
Yeah, Senator Specter.
Yeah.
After President Kennedy was assassinated in 63, you came up with the single bullet theory. And for quite a few years now, I've been studying the assassination of President Kennedy, and I kind of disagree with that, and a lot of other people do. How did you come up with the single bullet theory about Oswald?
I hope nobody has plans from now till midnight. I came up with the single bullet theory because of the evidence on the wounds on the president and the governor, and I can give it to you in 2 minutes. After you buy Never Give In and read it, go buy Passion for Truth, because I wrote that book because I get so many questions about the single bullet theory. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. That's 143 years ago. And they're still writing books about the Lincoln assassination. And they will be writing books about the Kennedy assassination for how long, I do not know. But I came up with it, so I wrote it down. The president was hit by two bullets. A subsequent shot hit him in the back of the head and killed him. He was hit by an earlier bullet, which hit at the base of the neck, passed between two large strap muscles, and exited with great velocity. We know the velocity of the Mannlicher Carcano was 2,200 feet per second, and we measured the distance, and it diminished by about 200 feet, and the governor had a wound slightly to the left of his right armpit, and the bullet had a little yaw consistent with coming out of the president's throat. Grazed a rib, sitting on a jump seat, went through his wrist and lodged in his thigh. And that's a strange path for a bullet, but we know sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. ABC did a 2-hour documentary on the 40th anniversary of the assassination and said it wasn't the single bullet theory anymore. It was the single bullet fact. On the conspiracy, had there been a conspiracy with Oswald, I think we would have known about it a long time ago. Nothing stays secret in our society. Now let me ask you a question. Where do people go to buy the book? Where?
In the lobby.
In the lobby, upstairs. So they have to pass by the bookseller?
Yes.
You have to pass by the bookseller. I only gave you a very thumbnail description here. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.